During times in this episode, there is sensitive content that may be traumatizing to some audiences. Listener discretion advised. It's Jennifer Diane Gostin, and welcome to Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. A part of my identity is being an adoptee, being separated at birth from my original family and placed into foster care for 2 years has significantly impacted how I see my place in the world. You may have wondered what reunion looks like from an adoptee's point of view, or be embarking upon taking that journey yourself to search for your first family, or simply want confirmation that you are not alone in your experience. Wouldn't it be empowering to have many of your burning questions answered here? I had the pleasure of getting to know my guests today through not one, but two other adoptees. First was with Simon Benn, host of the podcast Thriving Adoptees, when he introduced us via email. And then with Melissa Brunetti, the host of the podcast Mind Your Own Karma. Her name is Monica Hall. She and I had enjoyable Zoom meetings together months in advance of recording a conversation in an effort to know each other better. It was fun and meaningful going to her impressive website to read her words. In part, her bio states that she was born in Canada, adopted by American parents, and raised in Anchorage, Alaska. It was there where she spent the first 16 years of her life and had many of the foundational experiences that drive her writing. Monica now lives in Northern California and began working on a memoir in spring of 2016 when her daughter urged her to document her extraordinary but painful past. As she has gained access to buried memories through the process of writing about her experiences, Monica has realized just how self-preserving the human mind can be. She was astonished to discover how much she had willfully forgotten, how much pain she harbored from her early years, and how much guilt she had repressed in her adult life. Digging to the core of her memories as part of the writing process has allowed Monica to begin healing her wounds, forgive both herself and the people who wronged her, and shed the guilt she had lived with for decades. Ultimately, she hopes her writing will inspire others by proving that it's possible to overcome difficult circumstances and succeed. She is a published author, and I'm excited to announce that her memoir, Practically Still a Virgin, was released on March 21st. I look forward to getting my copy soon and diving right into the twists and turns of her lived experience. Allow me to introduce you to a person who can and does write from two sides of the adoption constellation. She has been a mentor, coach, and speaker, sharing her success story, giving hope for over three decades to those in crises. She devotes much of her time to working with women by guiding them through life's challenges. This has been instrumental in her development, and she describes it as a life-changing experience. Freely giving of her time has helped her to shed a self-centered worldview and gain new insight into human motivation and interactions. Mentoring gives her a sense of peace and has helped her to live her life with less judgment of herself and others. Monica Hall, I am so happy to have this conversation with you. We've had an opportunity to meet via Zoom, and I feel like I've gotten to know you pretty good listening to your story on other podcasts. And so I just welcome you and thank you so much for taking the time out today.
Well, thanks so much, Jennifer. It's been great having periodic Zooms with you and getting to know you over Zoom. Someday we'll meet in person.
Yeah, we had such a lovely time talking about your full journey so far. Yeah. And I know Simon Benn introduced us initially, but we just took it from there, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Yeah. And what we said right before I pushed record, we're going to just trust the universe to use us to have hopefully a powerful, meaningful, and purposeful conversation for the listeners. I'm going to start by asking you, how are you doing in California? I think you're in Folsom.
I'm in Fair Oaks, but it's close to Folsom. People don't know where Fair Oaks is, but people remember Johnny Cash and Folsom Prison, so I'm super close to that. And it's beautiful today. I just went outside and walked in my backyard. I think it's probably close to 50, but the sun's out and it's so pretty. And my garden's starting to bud. And yeah, love it. I love it.
That's great. But you started out in Canada. You were born there and then adopted by American parents and raised in Anchorage, Alaska. I just imagine the things that I know you as an adopted person and also as a birth mom who relinquished a daughter. It's so much, so many twists and turns, which I know is going to be in your book. Well, it's out now. When this airs anyway, it will be out into the world. So congratulations on publishing.
Thank you. It's been 8 years of working on that.
Wow.
8 years. Oh my gosh.
How does it feel to be on the other side of writing it?
It's really weird because yesterday, you know, we're airing, you know, we're recording this in advance of the publication. It's still not completely out, but I did send it out to a number of readers to, you know, to read in advance. And that morning when I was doing my meditation and kind of just sitting contemplation, I had a reading. I read something that talked about letting go of the past. It was so accurate for where I was. And I had this overwhelming feeling of, I don't know even how to describe it, maybe a kind of a sadness of a letting go of the of my truth, I guess. You know, it's like it's out there and 100 people have it in their hands right now. And yeah, you know, unless one does that, write a book and, you know, have it about, because this is a story. It's not, it's like a, it reads like a novel. It's not, you know, it doesn't have a lot of outside voice. You know, I don't think somebody writes unless they've got something that happened, you know, and I had a lot of things that happened. And it's so interesting because when I first started writing, I had no idea that it was going to be about what it was. I didn't have an idea, no idea what I was going to discover from my past through the writing process and through the investigation process. And so bringing up all that, some of it was very dark and it was joy, you know, being on the other side of all those things and having survived. But it's not like it ever goes away. Grief doesn't always go away. It's like a shapeshifter. It just changes. And it's not just grief. It's joy and it's gratitude too. Because if I hadn't have gone through all those life experiences, I wouldn't be in this place where I am now. And I'm human. I have ups and downs, but boy, my heart's been broken open. You know, it's not the same. I'm not the same. Like before I started writing in 2016. So it was really 7 years of writing, but birthing a book is a whole nother story. And then regurgitating it on podcasts and on book discussion groups and such. You know, I've noticed that when I get off one of those interviews, my heart's heavy again. You know, I feel, and that's the other thing I've come to notice, be so more self-aware. I mean, I've certainly done that over the last 40 or so years since I started really working on myself. But, you know, like I was driving home from Staples the other day and I was angry. Like, I am so pissed right now about what, you know, I could feel it in my body.
And you didn't know what it was.
Right.
For.
We don't always know. And it was uncomfortable. It was more like a feeling of I was disconnected. It just felt like there's something going on here. I've learned to pause and look, okay, so what triggered this? And where is this coming from? And let's sit with this instead of push it down in some way, which is what, you know, I've always done throughout my life. I've either, you know, I had problems with addiction and I would drink and use drugs, or I would buy something or I'd eat something. Or when I was young, my survival strategy was being a wrecking ball. You know, it's like, again, it's a shapeshifter, but it doesn't, you know, it's like this is a path, right? We just keep moving through it and hopefully become more aware and learn strategies and tools to navigate the waters.
Yeah. I really like everything you said on the other side of writing. I would have to agree that I did learn grief doesn't always go away. And I truly was not the same person afterwards. And yeah, there's joy and gratitude and clearly more self-awareness. So yeah, thank you for those things that you shared that happened to you. And I know the title really struck me. I think it's a powerful title, Practically Still a Virgin. How did you come up with that title?
It's a line in my book. It's so funny because when I started writing, you know, I wanted to come up with a title and people gave me ideas. I had a developmental editor that I worked with and I would send her, you know, my work back and forth. And that's basically how I learned to write. She was a former college professor and I'd never been to school for writing. And I cut school all through junior high and in high school and no college really, just some chemistry. But I would look for a name and some, you know, I've been told it'll come when it's supposed to. And one day, I don't know if I woke up and went, this is it. And it's a line in my book and it threads everything together. It's provocative, which is cool because then people go, oh, what's this? And they'll possibly read it. Hopefully they'll read it because it's about survival. It's about healing. It's about, you know, it's inspiring. And you know, the human spirit, the tenacity of the human spirit is a powerful, powerful thing. You know, it doesn't have to destroy us, our past. My past is my greatest gift. I had a very religious upbringing. They were Catholic, my adoptive parents, and older. They were, you know, their childhoods were in the Depression. My father was an alcoholic. He only drank for 2 years. He had, I guess, quit prior to adopting me, but he was also very inappropriate. And I don't get into a lot of that in this book. You can definitely feel there's something up, you know, and there's a definite physical abuse. And our house was a constant gaslighting event, dysfunction, just really sick dysfunction. And that's how I grew up. I didn't know anything different. I think one of my survival strategies was at 13, I had an event that happened with my father that was, it was so traumatizing. It's probably one of the most traumatizing. And I've had 11 big T traumas. I went through a EMDR eye movement reprocessing desensitization through 2020 with a therapist over Zoom, and we worked on 11 big T traumas. So I've had a lot of trauma. This one, even though I wasn't physically hurt, was the most damaging, and it's what changed my trajectory. This is when I changed. I wanted to be good. I wanted to be praised. I wanted my parents to think well of me, and I just clicked and became a juvenile delinquent. But by God, I was going to be a virgin because up in Alaska, people moved up there, especially during the oil boom or even before, you know, just to escape their past or to start anew, or, you know, they were hiding or they knew that there was a little bit, hardly any law. There was lots of gambling and prostitution. It was kind of a lawless, crazy place, especially during the oil boom. I mean, even before the oil boom, you know, people would go up there. I mean, who goes to an isolated place like Alaska on purpose? There's a reason. And maybe it's fishing and hunting, but that was never my dad's deal. He was not an outdoorsman. He ended up being a businessman. And so my mother was put on a pedestal because he had met her when she was 15, like she'd been 15 for a week when she was a virgin. And, you know, he had a really dark past, which I have since, you know, delved into to try to understand what makes people the way they are, you know. And my mom was put on a pedestal, and he would say to my brother and I when we were little, like 8, 9, 10, Mama's a saint. I couldn't even get her in the sack until we were married. Oh yeah, Mama's a saint. So we had a lot of really weird virgin Madonna identity crap going on in our house. And my dad favored me, and he was emotionally and verbally abusive to my brother. And it was just a mess. I got raped, and I had snuck out my bedroom window, and I never told anybody. And I didn't really understand I guess I knew I had sex. I knew I was no longer a virgin. I don't think my mind could wrap my head around it. I was in denial. You know, it's so weird what your mind will do, but subconsciously, I was going to be good because of the weird shit that went on in my household, that is in the book. And so I hadn't had a period for a couple months, and I'm a sophomore in high school. We just started at the high school. We were on double shifts. Junior high was ninth grade up through ninth grade. We were on double shifts in junior high and high school because we had thousands and thousands of family moving to Alaska because of the oil boom. And so I was walking to the nurse's office because my girlfriend said, "Well, maybe you should see the nurse. Do you think you could be pregnant?" "No, I couldn't be pregnant." And of course, I never told anybody what happened. Felt such shame. And I remember on the way to the nurse's office, I said to myself, "I can't be pregnant. I'm practically still a virgin." And it was that denial that I had. And you know, that's where it was actually something I said in my head that I had probably repressed. And then, you know, it came up one morning. I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I said that," or "I thought that." You know, it was this denial that I lived with. And I did that with a lot that happened in my family because my brain protected me. And it was unweaving and unwinding that over the course of 7 years of writing. And there were some dark times, I'm telling you, really dark times, you know, where I almost quit writing, where I thought I can't do this anymore because I was discovering things that I'd repressed. You know, weave in that being an adoptee and a birth mother and all different kinds of grief and reunions. And yeah, it was a lot. And but the title, it's so perfect. Wait till you read it, Jennifer. You're gonna go, "Oh my God."
Yes, I'm excited to get my copy. I look forward to reading it. And, you know, I'm sorry that you experienced a sexual assault. I am sorry that happened to you. I wanted to go back to something you said, just so that listeners maybe can have a little bit more clarification. I certainly get it when you say your past is a powerful gift. Even in your case, it's very dark. It's very hard. It's a lot that has gone on that is traumatic. And so, how were you able to come to a place to frame it as a gift?
Such a weird thing, isn't it? It sounds, especially when you've had a lot of, you know, difficulties and maybe even still experiencing difficulties in your life today, as we all do, but you know, to different varying degrees, everybody's different. It sounds so like how could you say that? That's just really shitty, you know. But it's an experience. You know, it wasn't until I stopped drinking and using drugs in 1984 that I really started looking at myself and the way I frame things and what I did in my life and took responsibility for my life going forward. You know, and through that journey of the last 4 decades, I've done a lot of searching. You know, like I was raised Catholic, but I've had a spiritual path that has just woven together so much identity for me in my heart. It is. And I think there's a part, certainly for me, the cover of my memoir is this beautiful young girl, which is me. And I look at that cover and I think, "Oh, that poor thing." You know, I don't identify her as me, but she's cracked. It looks like a puzzle piece. I was at my daughter's last night and I was showing my cover because the book hasn't launched yet, to my grandson who's 7 and my daughter and a couple friends who were over. And, you know, I had it mocked up on a book of the same size. And Miles, my grandson, said, "Grandma, you know, why is your," and somebody else had asked, "Why are you know, cracked?" But I said, "Well, I'm shattered." And he pointed to my heart and he said, "In here." And it brought tears to my eyes. Like the children can see, you know, he's only 7 and he doesn't know my story, but he knows that I was cracked in my heart and my identity. And it's when those cracks open that light can come in. Over the years of, you know, the spiritual journey that I've done, yeah, it's shown some brilliance, some light, because I'm doing work. I'm looking for something more. something more than my past, something more than the broken heart, something more than what happened to me. You know, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. You know, there's the story of a little boy, and he's in this huge room, and he's got this shovel, and he's shoveling shit, just shoveling, shoveling. And someone says, "What are you doing?" He goes, "There's got to be a pony in here somewhere."
Right. And I figured you would answer exactly the way you did, that spirituality is how you came to frame it that way, through spirituality. I often say, I think that when I turn my pain into purpose, that's when it has become the gift. And there's something I say pretty much every day, is that I prefer that things be the way that they are. And I don't know the author of that, where I got it from. Do apologize. I just know that when I first heard it, I was like, why? Well, if things aren't going so well, why would I prefer that they be that way? But what I've come to understand is that it can become a gift, because whatever is happening, it is an opportunity for me to either see it to my detriment or to my growth. Like, that's a choice that I have in every moment. And sometimes we have to pause because it is hard. It's really dark, or it's really something that we didn't anticipate or would wish for. But somehow, if we can sit with it and come to understand, right, stay, remain open and curious to understanding, that somewhere along, as we continue to move forward, we'll come to understand how it has become something that has helped us. And as an adopted person, that's like the perfect example, right? Being separated from your family of origin, not having information about your beginnings, on and on and on. It's dark. That's dark. And yet, when I think of my connection to the adoption community, meeting people like yourself, all of these connections would likely not have happened if I hadn't been adopted. The beauty that has come out of being able to learn and grow and understand from members of the community, it's just been life-changing in ways I could not even predict. So that was like a long way to say that spirituality has in fact shown me where gifts come from and how the circumstances do become gifts. So thank you for your response to that question.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You mentioned something that I've heard Dr. Gabor Maté talk about, which is traumas, the big T's. He talks about the little T's and the big T's. What is your definition of the big T's?
Well, it wasn't really my definition. It was my therapist's definition, because I didn't really identify as having traumas. You know, they're just things I lived with, things that happened. And now, you know, things have changed. People are identifying more. I initially, you know, started working with her to try to gain access to some repressed memories. So I knew something had happened. I had an age regression hypnosis in the 90s that knew something happened, but I didn't trust it. And I didn't believe it because I didn't remember it. I wanted to know for sure so I didn't feel crazy, like I'd made something up. Because when things happen to us that are traumatic, especially when they're done by someone that we love and trust, it is, I'm not talking about the rape, I remember that vividly. It's common for somebody to say, that can't have happened, and to start doubting yourself, because we can't believe that someone that we trusted and loved, like a parent, could hurt us like that. It's just, it's our mind. But I needed to know, and I didn't want to know. And thank God my memory and my mind has protected me, because there's so much still repressed, and I'm good with that. But I now know for sure. And that's why I started, you know, because I wanted to get this memory. And then as we went through the process, you know, there's an intake where they have to go through and, you know, they list them and then they analyze them so that they know how to work with them when you're actually going through the EMDR process. It took almost a year to go through the whole process because I had 11 big T traumas. So one of them I was clearly identified, and even though it's a pre-verbal trauma, is being relinquished. So I was in a foster home for 3.5, 4 months. So that was obviously a trauma. The rape was definitely a trauma. That was a big T trauma. Duh. I had been abducted at knife point at one point, which I escaped. That was definitely a trauma. That was terrifying. In front of the screen, she'd go, you don't just have one. Most people have one big T trauma and some small T traumas, but you have big T trauma, big T trauma, big T trauma. And she kept making a T with her fingers. You know, I think I came here to this life, this planet, or whatever you want to say, strong, being able to handle this. I'm not your sensitive type. You know, I really respect those that are poets and artists and musicians, but they feel everything. It's all there and it's very difficult. I don't. I have pushed things down, and I was a strong kid and I was tomboy, and that's where I was made, so that I could handle this stuff. It's not to say that it didn't change my life and cause me, or you know, to make poor choices in many cases, which many of them are in my book. It's kind of a tell-all of me. And I think part of that was trying to forgive myself for being an asshole when I was young. I had posted on Facebook, and a number of people from Anchorage, I was asking questions about the cover. Should I do this? Should I do that? Somebody I didn't know said, does it talk about beatings and bullying? I'm like, yeah, I think that's part of the reason that I had to write it, is to try to figure out why I was such an asshole. And those were my survival strategies. So big T traumas are, to me, the ones that are physical and horrific. And the small T traumas, which I didn't even know what those were, be honest with you, until I talked to somebody, it's constant gaslighting and lying and making you feel like your family, like you don't, like you're crazy. Like there's a lot of that. That was all we had, just dysfunction. And I escaped when I was 21. I moved out at 26. I got sober and I worked on myself. I'm not, for the most part, I'm not codependent anymore. I mean, when you read my book, you'll see what my family was like. And it's my gift. Like it's my gift, because I couldn't have healed these things and gone through these things, and they're all healed and they'll probably never be, but I can help others. I posted essays on my blog writing since I started, and I had so many people reach out to me and tell me these secrets through email that they've never shared with anybody, because when we don't feel alone, when we see somebody else has gone through something, it gives me peace. That's why these podcasts are so powerful, and books, and people being honest and vulnerable, you know, it makes us go, oh, my secret, it's not so bad right now.
I agree. Yeah, thank you for sharing all of that. I know you're in reunion with your biological daughter, and I just wonder, what is that like adoptee to adoptee?
It's, you know, I was just seeing something on Instagram yesterday that I commented on. A young woman had shown a picture side by side of herself and her birth mother, and the first picture she ever saw of her birth mother, it was uncanny. They look so much alike. You could not mistake it. And I commented and I said, that's how I felt when I saw the picture of my daughter for the first time, because I had contacted the adoption agency. I'd waited 18 years. I counted the years. I could hardly wait to meet her. It's all I held on to. And 6 months early, I couldn't wait. So I called the adoption agency in Alaska. By then I was living in California, you know, told them that I wanted to do, you know, to meet her or whatever. And they said, well, it's 6 months too early. Write us a letter and we'll forward it to the parents. And if they're interested in a reunification, then we'll facilitate it. You know, so what my brain heard is, if they like what I wrote, then they'll let me meet my daughter. At the time, I still had them on a pedestal. Now I see them as more human, but that's the, you know, injustice or the inequity, you know, it's not balanced between a birth parent and an adoption. You know, the adoptive parents always seem to be so better, you know, more worthy, smarter, more money, more successful, you know, that. And I felt so much shame, you know, having relinquished. You know, they said, write us a letter. So I put the phone down, figured I had 6 months to come up with something to say. And within a couple of weeks, I got a call at my desk, and they apologized for not getting back to me sooner, but they had a picture of my daughter. And she had called within a couple days of my call 6 months early. And adoption in 1991 in Alaska was open. Thank God, because she lived in Michigan, and Michigan adoption laws are slam shut. They're really working right now at trying to get, you know, the laws changed in Michigan. And so that's why she started early, because she knew that they were, her mother's friend was adopted and couldn't get her papers. So that's why they started early for Mary. So when I came home after they mailed it, I had my neighbor check in the mailbox, you know, and I came home on a late lunch, and I sat down on my porch and opened that envelope. And when I looked at her, it was like looking at myself. It was the most weird out of body experience. It's like, I knew her, like I'd known her all my life. And it was like, you know, I can't even describe it. It was her senior portrait, and she was kind of leaning back on a chair. We both have dark hair. I'm blonde now, and so is she actually, but we have dark hair, and that was the, you know, the 90s when perms were in. So we have very straight hair, and we both had our hair the same color. Oh my gosh, you know, being somebody that's adopted now. By then I'd had my own child. My daughter was, I think, 9. She wasn't grown, and there was some similarities, but not like with my daughter, Mary. And her name is Mary too. My parents named me Mary Monica. They named her Mary Claire. So we ended up with the same first names, both named after the Virgin Mary, Catholic family, you know, and it was just out of body, and it was so fulfilling. Oh my God, so fulfilling. And they did let me see her in the hospital, because I insisted. The Catholic, you know, hospital didn't allow the birth mothers to see their babies, but I had groomed the nun that was doing the facilitation of adoption and counseling me to let me see my baby, because I was adopted and I didn't have another human that was my relative.
Yeah.
You know? No.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was huge.
You know, I'm looking at your website right now, the picture of you and your daughter. It's titled, My Daughter Finally Named Her Adoptee Pain. You're both beautiful women, and you look just alike. I urge everybody to check that out. Go to monicahall.com. It's really a lot of beautiful pictures on there, but I can only imagine what that experience was like to first put eyes on her after all these years later. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes me cry just thinking about it.
Beautiful picture of you too. I want to talk a little bit about being connected to the adoption community, especially since you are a birth mom and an adoptee. What has the experience been like to be better connected to the community from both those sides?
It's super interesting, because I didn't know there was a community in 2016 when I started writing. You know, that term coming out of the fog, I started listening to a podcast, a popular podcast, and hearing other adoptees. And adoption was normalized in my family, you know, because my brother and I were both adopted. I had relinquished, you know, so I still had the were gifts, you know, type of mentality. And it really was a brainwashing. And I had to unwind that for myself to see it more clearly. And, you know, it's still difficult, you know, to unwind. It was super hard to write. Oh my gosh, super hard to write. You know, that, you know, I didn't understand why I felt uncomfortable being thanked for relinquishing, and, you know, that my daughter was a gift. And you know, no, I never gave my daughter as a gift. You don't give a human, especially your baby, as a gift. It was a gift to her. I gave her two parents. That was always for her. It was never for the parent. And it was so hard to unwind all that stuff in my brain. And do I regret giving her up? Sure. Absolutely. Do I think I did the right thing? I think there's destiny. I know there's destiny, and this was our destiny. So yeah, it was what was supposed to happen. When I first started listening to these podcasts and connecting to other adoptees, it was just unbelievable that I wasn't the only one. And so many things, see, because I'm not sensitive, I don't feel everything. I don't feel the emotions, although they come out in other ways. And I started identifying things and connecting things, that feeling like an alien and feeling, alone and, some of my addictions. My goodness, I started using drugs, mostly psychedelics, when I was in, Alaska, when I was 13, and sneaking out my bedroom window. But I didn't have my first drink, really my first drink, until my father passed away when I was 19. Then I started reading books and understanding, the amount of adoptees that have addiction issues and promiscuity issues and, in rehabs and dysfunction and trouble with the law and things like that, especially when we were kids. I started kind of forgiving myself. Like, yeah, these are my survival strategies. So hearing all these stories and connecting was just huge for me to feel like I wasn't alone. However, this was in 2016 when I was listening to these podcasts and I was hearing a lot of anger from adoptees to their birth parents. And it scared me. I was afraid that I wasn't going to be accepted because I'm an adoptee first. And when you read my book, you'll understand how that, relinquishing one's own child, being an adoptee, happened. It was scary because I felt like I wasn't going to be accepted. And I haven't experienced that. I have not yet. And, maybe people were thinking that or saying that. I haven't heard it. And, not everybody's going to like what I have to say. It's just the way it is. I'm here to help. And for those that can hear it, great. And those that can't, move on. It's grief is a shapeshifter, so is healing. It changes and it grows and it, it's an up and down thing. It's a wave. Just ride the wave and get out of the way.
Yeah, and trust the universe, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the part about destiny, I mean, that is trusting the universe. I had a mentor many years ago, and I was so upset because my marriage hadn't worked. I met him when I got first sober, and he got drunk, and I was had a baby, right away, and he wasn't in her life. He moved out of town, and I so wanted my daughter to have connection to family because I didn't, being an adoptee by then. I did find my biological family in Canada, but I wasn't, I didn't live there. I couldn't be at all the events that they were at. And my family, we didn't have anybody come over. We had no family. I didn't have aunts and uncles or cousins. Nobody came to my house. My parents were weird. It was a dark place to be. And I wanted my daughter to have that I didn't have. And her dad moved away. And this woman said to me, she goes, "How do you know it's not Rebecca's destiny to miss her father?" And it landed with me. Who am I to say that that wasn't her destiny and this wasn't mine? All of this wasn't mine. And that's a spiritual thought, isn't it?
Yes. Well, congratulations on every single thing, your sobriety. And I know a part of your bio states the journey of self-discovery and self-love and finding ways to come out the other side stronger than ever. So I look forward to getting a copy of your book. I probably will have it in my hands by the time this airs. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you'd like to share?
Oh, probably. I could go on for hours. I wrote a damn book, for heaven's sakes.
I think when
Actually.
we did the Zoom, if I'm not mistaken, we were on there for over an hour. It might have been,
Oh, we had a couple hours. It
yeah,
was
I think it
so,
was
yeah.
2 hours, wasn't it?
It was. We've talked more than once on Zoom.
It was so much
I haven't
fun.
I have a second book. I mean, I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, and I just had to write. I had to get it out. And the last thing I'll say is, well, the second book is, you know, come out probably next year. The stuff that I discovered that I couldn't put in this one, because this, you know, it reads like a novel. It's, you know, normal novel sized book. I guess I could just say that just keep on the journey. Keep listening to stories. Look for connection. Join groups. Hot penny is such a great thing to do. So I learned this early when I first got sober, is when I am exploding, either I'm angry, I don't know what's going on in my head, or I'm pissed about something, or I'm having a feeling and I don't even know what the feeling is, I pull out a piece of paper. It can be any kind of paper. It doesn't have to be a journal. It can be unlined. It can be printer paper. And I take a pen or whatever's close and I just start writing. And it doesn't make sense. It's not spelled. You can't read it. It's called hot penning. And it's been such a huge tool for me to get it out. And it doesn't matter if it makes sense. It doesn't matter what it is.
Thank you for sharing that. Hot penning. Like P-E-N-N-I-N-G, penning.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm going to try that. I journal pretty much every day, but I don't think I've ever done it quite like that. Well, maybe I have, but I like that, hot penning.
There was a time when I was really upset about my daughter, the one that I kept, and I was terrified for her. And I didn't know what to do. 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 I couldn't call anybody. I was too screwed up to call anybody. And I wanted a drink, but I wasn't going to drink. And I just stood at my counter and pulled out a piece of paper and started writing. And I was relieved. It relieved it.
Yeah. Typically, I sit down and I kind of formulate my thoughts, right? But what you're suggesting is just write.
Mm-hmm. When it's excruciating.
Yeah.
When you feel like you're going to explode or you can't take it anymore.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I do coach people and I help them with tools similar to that. And there's so many tools and there's so many resources out there now from other adoptees. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. And I understand you are going to read something from your book or on the cover.
I can just read the back, yeah. And this is just the short. Adopted and raised during Alaska's lawless 1970s oil boom era, Monica grows up amid trauma and dysfunction. As a teen, she rebels into delinquency. When Monica is raped and becomes pregnant, her religious parents push her into giving up her baby, only known blood relative, for adoption. These events kicked off a decades-long search for family and belonging. Thread by thread, she weaves together the truth of her identity, pulled by yearning for her daughter and the mother who gave her away.
Beautiful. Thank you again, Monica, for having this conversation with me. It's been great.
Thank you. I enjoy it every time.
When something or someone keeps garnering my attention, as was the case with Monica, I get still and listen until a call of action is the next logical step. And so it was. I requested a Zoom meeting with her, which was filled with a synergy that was life-giving for me. During our time together, Monica was open and honest about many of her decisions, even if it didn't paint her in a favorable light. As a result, I believe that her vulnerability just might set the wheels in motion for a listener or two to share a part of their story, which can be a component of healing for them. Monica's willingness to be public about the trauma of being relinquished as an infant during her teen years, relinquishing a daughter to adoption, and all the other big T traumas along the way is emotional labor on a whole other level for most of the guests that I've had the absolute privilege to engage in conversation with on this subject. Thank you, Monica, for having this conversation with me. Like you, I enjoy writing in the early morning hours when my world is quiet and my mind is open. I can always appreciate getting to know a guest prior to pushing the record button, and the fellowship with you over the course of several months affirms why it's meaningful to be connected to our community in this way. Through your words, I got a firsthand look at what it must have been like for an adopted person to go on to be a birth mother relinquishing a child to adoption during a closed system. You write in your blog a piece titled, "My Daughter Finally Named Her Adoptee Pain," the following riveting words from one paragraph. "I have now been part of my daughter's life longer than I was absent from it. We had both counted the years until she turned 18 and we could find each other. Our reunion was the beginning of healing our wounds. But a mother's absence from her child can never be made whole." If you're an adoptee and would like to share your adoption journey, visit JenniferDianeGolston.com. If you like Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow and or give, hopefully, a 5-star rating so others can find it too. During the course of your day, I trust you will tell at least one friend or someone who you believe might find value in it, because word of mouth is still the very best way for the show to grow. Thank you for being here.